You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The pandemic has been a confusing time for us consumers. First, there was the scarce toilet paper. Finding flour and yeast was hit and miss. Hand sanitizers, they dried up. And then the meat shortages. COVID-19 ripped through processing plants. Perhaps the most troubling was in the area of PPE, personal protective equipment. So what's happened to the laws of supply and demand? Where are global supply chains breaking down? What confuses you about the shortages you see? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. Greg DeCroix is the Granger Professor of Supply Chain Management and Academic Director of the UW School of Business Granger Center for Supply Chain Management. Greg, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Great to be here.
And your colleague, Pete Luxas, is here as well, senior lecturer at the UW School of Business Granger Center for Supply Chain Management and teaching logistics and supply chain IT. Pete, welcome to you.
Good morning, Kate.
Well, Pete, I'm going to start with a very basic one here, but allow me, please, what defines a supply chain?
Right. A supply chain typically spans the boundaries of multiple companies and even multiple countries. And we define a supply chain going from the end supplier all the way to the end customer. There's many participants in a supply chain, manufacturers, distributors, retail stores, and of course, the final customer.
And that final customer, from beginning to end, that supply chain may crisscross the world. Is that right?
Absolutely. It's more of a network, a supply chain network that spans many different companies. It could be transportation providers like FedEx or UPS, but they are very complex beings.
So, Pete, you know, Pete, we've seen so much, change and flux in products. What is happening here during the pandemic? Why are there shortages of one thing and there's plenty of something else?
Yeah, that's really the big question here. I think the short answer is every one of these products, whether it's hand sanitizer or toilet paper or sanitizing wipes, has a different story and, you know, has a different answer. It's caused by more than one issue. You know, you take hand sanitizer, when customers go on allocation from manufacturers or distributors, it's the hospitals or the healthcare organizations that are going to get the hand sanitizer first, which, you know, obviously makes sense.
Greg, what are you seeing in supply chain? What is standing out to you as this pandemic has thrown so much out of whack?
Well, one of the things that I think strikes those of us to think about supply chains more often than the average consumer is that this disruption, this shock to the system is so different from anything else we've seen in the past. Supply chains get disrupted from time to time, and most of the time it doesn't make the news. Sometimes it's a big enough issue that it does. Some listeners may recall back in 2011, there was the major earthquake off the coast of Japan that led to a tsunami that shut down certain component and parts suppliers and various, you know, affected the auto industry and some other industries for a period of some months. That same year, there was some heavy flooding in Thailand, in an area that happened to produce about half of the hard disk drives that the world used. And so that had a huge impact on anything that required those. But those were very focused, either on an industry or a region, maybe a small set of suppliers. The thing that's different about COVID is that it's a pandemic. I mean, it really does affect at a given tier in the supply chain, maybe a set of suppliers supplying similar level of components, let's say, it may affect many or all of them. It affects multiple tiers at the same time, upstream, downstream. And really one of the things that I think, particularly from a consumer's perspective, that's most striking is it's not just disrupting supply, it's having a huge impact on demands. And some demands are dropping precipitously, some demands are soaring, and they're sometimes going in the opposite direction of what we're seeing in terms of the supply of those goods. And when they go in those opposite directions, when the supply is cut dramatically and the demand soars, that's when you have the particularly bad shortages.
And so it sounds like just a storm of things happening. You start having to do workaround after workaround within the supply chain as things close up. But then also your customers are no longer predictable.
Exactly. A huge change in some sense, they may become predictable, but they're behaving very differently. For example, grocery store demand has gone up about 20%. Well, now we know that that is happening because people are eating at home rather than out in restaurants and so on. But it's very different from the way it used to be. And so there was certainly a transition period where people didn't know what was going to be happening and what the magnitude of it was going to be.
We're talking with two experts from the UW Granger Center for Supply Chain Management. We have Greg DeCroy there, academic director and professor, Pete Luxas, senior lecturer, and you. Have you seen examples, perhaps, of price gouging amid the pandemic? Have you found ways to get products that were out of stock or hard to find? If you haven't been able to find something, have you started making your own, or do you go without? What are your consuming tendencies during the pandemic, and how do you think that impacts supply and demand? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Pete, how do these companies forecast right now when so much seems to be very day-to-day amid the pandemic? Markets closed, markets open, manufacturers shut down for a limited time if there's an outbreak, and then they're back up again. What do forecasts look like?
Forecasting is extremely difficult in a pandemic. I think the first thing I would say is historical purchasing data in a pandemic means very little. So consumers before with alcohol wipes, maybe 50% of consumers regularly purchased alcohol wipes prior to COVID. Obviously, that's changed. Paper towel usage is something that is continuing to trend upwards as more restaurants, as more schools hopefully open here soon. To use spray bottles of disinfectants, you're going to be using more paper towels. Things like gloves. Nitrile and rubber and latex gloves, that usage has just completely changed. So I think the key thing to think of here is, usually with forecasting, historical data and different statistical methods are used, but you can kind of throw all that historical data out the window when you're in a pandemic situation.
Well, let's bring in John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering in particular about isopropyl alcohol. I hadn't been able to find it for like over a month in stores. I just finally got a hold of a couple bottles, but I would check multiple times a week at pharmacies and grocery stores, and they were always out. And it just seemed so odd because it's such a simple chemical. How hard could it be to increase supply to meet demand for that?
Pete, what's going on with isopropyl alcohol? You've been looking into this.
Sure. Yeah, that's an interesting story. John, you brought up not being able to find the bottles of rubbing alcohol or isopropyl alcohol. The first shortage was with the bottles themselves, because the bottles are used in the containers, and also the flip-off caps are used for different things, like in food, like with yogurt. Different small juice containers, that there was a huge shortage in the containers themselves. As I've been following it, some of the chemicals that are actually used to produce the isopropyl alcohol, what makes it coagulate, that chemical as well was in short supply.
Well, let's just pause here as we talk with Pete Luxas and Greg DeCroy with the UW School of Business Granger Center for Supply Chain Management. And your questions about supply and demand now, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're getting schooled on supply chain management amid the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Fortune magazine says the week of March 13th may go down as the great toilet paper panic of 2020. Analysts say TP sales on March 12th ballooned 734% compared with the same day the previous year. Shoppers hunkered down at home indefinitely to avoid the coronavirus. They wiped out Amazon supply and then supermarkets across America. Did you panic buy things at the beginning of the pandemic, like toilet paper or hand sanitizer? Did you feel like you didn't have any other option but to stock up? What do you want to know about how shortages and surpluses work? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. We have Professor Greg DeCroix and Senior Lecturer Pete Luxis with the UW School of Business Granger Center for Supply Chain Management. And Pete, I stopped you there on isopropyl alcohol, but you found that the packaging itself was in short supply and the chemicals that go into the product were also in disruption.
Well, right. So with making hand sanitizer in particular, isopropyl alcohol is one of the main ingredients. Then you also have water. You have some type of like oil to keep your hands soft. And then you also have hydrogen peroxide. But the bottles themselves were in short supply, which was one of the limiting factors.
Let's bring in Kate. Go ahead. Jump in.
I was just going to jump in and tack on that just as a more general point, is that that's something we're seeing in a lot of different things where to get a product or something in place that requires several different components. And we saw that in terms of COVID tests. First, there was a shortage of tests. Then there was a shortage of the reagent chemicals to analyze the tests. Then there was a shortage of swabs. And you have to have all the pieces in place in order for the whole thing to be effective. So that people may see that showing up over and over across a variety of different products.
Let's bring in Kay now in Milwaukee. Hi, Kay.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have not been able to find Lysol wipes. And I use them a lot. I have a 98-year-old father, and I want to be able to clean everything, and I can't find Lysol wipes anywhere.
Okay, thank you. Greg, what has happened with Lysol wipes?
Yeah, the problem there is that, there's sort of a spectrum of how easy it is to produce things, and hand sanitizer, I mean, pure isopropyl alcohol is at one end, but as Pete said, that's sometimes sort of taken over in order to use it for things like hand sanitizer. Hand sanitizer is a little bit easier to make, and you see different companies popping up, including breweries making it and things like that, or distilleries, rather. And, you know, the wipes require just a little bit more. They require whatever it is that the disinfectant is, but it also requires the fabric of the cloth itself to be produced and the container and so on. And similar to what Pete said about the hand sanitizer and isopropyl alcohol, some of those canisters, those upright canisters that we're used to seeing the wipes in, there were shortages of those. There's actually a company that has some production capacity here in Wisconsin that was, and some people may be familiar with more of the pouches, kind of like the baby wipes, kind of a pouch. They got approval from the EPA to put their product into those because they couldn't get the containers. And that's another factor here, is that some of these things are actually regulated. And so you need to, anytime you change packaging or production processes and so on, you need to get approval from certain agencies. And so for someone to just start up and do these things may be challenging to add capacity to the system because of the regulatory hurdles. I know that agencies are trying to very much fast-track approval for certain things, and companies are trying to add capacity. I know Clorox was, which is the market leader in terms of market share, and the wipes was really trying to add capacity. But to some extent, you know, this requires physical equipment, and it takes some time to put more in place. But they're working on it.
Yeah, Pete, sanitizing wipe makers, they have really not been able to catch up with this hugely increased demand. What are you seeing?
Yeah, to echo Greg's points, a lot of these supply chains, in particular the Lysol wipes, they've designed to be very efficient and perhaps too efficient, very cost effective. They're not good at scaling up
quickly or adding more capacity. And as Greg said, you know, incrementally, you could add another shift, you could do a little more, but it takes months to add more capacity to these lines. I mean, if you walk inside one of these plants, you have these big stainless steel vats where you're mixing up the disinfectants, and then you have packaging lines where you're doing the filling and the labeling. All of this equipment has to be installed. If it's FDA regulated, it has to be validated, and you have to, you know, put in all the computer control systems. So these things just take a long time. If they could have been done maybe 6 months in advance, you know, it would be a different story. But now we're kind of reacting to the situation.
We're talking with two researchers from the UW-Granger Center for Supply Chain Management. Pete Luxas there, senior lecturer. Greg DeCroix is academic director and a professor. And you, with your questions, what do you think that? Why do you think there have been shortages like sanitizing wipes or meat products? Do you think it's because people are panic buying? Do you worry about food supply chain and the potential for shortages there? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Greg, I want to ask you about blockchain technology and being able to hyper-see where the issues are in your supply chain and then just going in there and fixing that. What does blockchain have to do with this?
That's a good question. Blockchain is it's a technology. Some people may be familiar with it. It's the technology behind cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. It's essentially a try not to get too technical here, but it's this distributed ledger. It's this record that's out there, and it's the record is kept in many different places simultaneously, and it has a certain kind of a process for updating the records, and it is very, very difficult for anyone to go in and kind of be fraudulent and change something that isn't legitimate. So it's a really good potential technology for validating what is going on and that, you know, legitimizing maybe a supplier or a transaction or things like that. There are different versions of it. There are public versions, there are private versions, and blockchain in and of itself doesn't necessarily give you full visibility throughout the supply chain unless the entities in the supply chain choose to be participants and go along with it.
Oh, they have to buy into it.
Well, they have to they have to be part of the, you know, again, a lot of companies will go with a private blockchain where they're working within their own relationships that they have, and it's something that requires participation, I guess I'd say, for companies to have full visibility. And that can be something that really is an issue when you think about my supplier and my supplier's supplier and my supplier's supplier. You know, you go down three tiers and then they're outsourcing it to someone else. Sometimes something can happen somewhere where you don't even know that party is part of the system, and a problem occurs and it can affect you. Now, I'm trying to think whether that would have much of an impact on a situation like this. All of the things, you know, we kind of saw this coming and we knew it could potentially have an impact. No, you know, we didn't perhaps know exactly how pervasive it was going to be, but I don't know that blockchain would have provided a whole lot of help in a situation like this.
Well, let's take another call. Nicholas in Mineral Point. Hi, Nicholas.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I've got a question about supply chain for items like egg cartons. I'm a small pasture poultry operator in Mineral Point, Wisconsin, but I realized that it was cheaper for me to order 60,000 cartons at one time than it was to be ordering 5,000, 6,000, 10,000. Anyways, I placed my order for my egg cartons in February. Original date to landing was May 15th, I believe it was. I just got word that I won't see them until September.
Wow.
But a friend of mine who is a egg carton distributor in Mason City, Iowa, normally has 2 to 4 million cartons at any given time in stock. He has zero. He has 16 semi-loads on order, and they are saying that he won't see any of them until September. What is going on?
Pete, do you want to field that first?
Yeah, I'll try and take a stab at it. So, you know, again, it comes down to some constraint that's going on. You know, most likely it's not a labor constraint because there's people still working at the egg carton factories. It looks like it's on allocation. So whenever there's a shortage of something in a supply chain and there's a short supply and there's more demand than supply, the customers, like you, Nicholas, probably have gone on allocation. It's good you're at least getting an order date. I don't know how good of a date that is that they're giving you, if it's going to end up being September. But, you know, somehow there's a prioritization system that the vendor is using to allocate that scarce supply. I'm not sure whether there could be a chemical or some, you know, component again that's short that the manufacturers are dealing with, but it's usually not just one factor.
We have Pete Luxis and Greg DeCroix with us there with the UW School of Business. We're looking at supply chain management, what it means for the products in our life. With your questions, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're getting a tutorial on supply chains and the disruptions amid the pandemic. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. So in recent decades, raw materials and goods, they're shipped around the world multiple times and then assembled in yet another location. The final output is re-exported to people in both the developed and developing world. Does the coronavirus spell the end of the global supply chain, or at least a shorter chain? Some manufacturing experts say supply chains have to get shorter. So how will food production adapt when the world reopens? What do you think are America's vulnerabilities? Be part of this. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have two researchers from the UW School of Business. They stay with us, Pete Luxis and Greg DeCroix. Let's look at the food supply chain, Greg. The pandemic has really upended it, both for regular consumers and for restaurants, hotels, schools. Can you help us understand what's going on in the food supply?
Sure. I think one of the most striking things about the food supply chain is at one point you see certain items in stores that maybe the shelves are looking empty or not quite the same selection you're used to, prices going up. And on the other hand, you read stories about dairy farmers dumping milk or, you know, pigs having to be euthanized and things like that. And it seems like it's just completely a disconnect. And that's almost literally what it is. The food supply chain is actually ends up being two supply chains once it gets towards the end. You have one distribution system that feeds commercial market, restaurants, schools, et cetera, businesses, and another one that feeds into the grocery store market. They're not entirely distinct, but it's easiest to think of them that way. They're largely distinct. And so this is a little bit of what I was mentioning earlier, where you have these disruptions that affect supply and also affect demand. And you have the commercial supply chain being, to a large extent, shut down because their demand, you know, businesses are closed, restaurants are closed, and so on. And so everybody is eating at home, and therefore grocery demand has gone up by about, I think about 20% or so is the number that I saw. And so that is what is causing this imbalance. It's not trivial to simply shift over from shipping things to restaurants to shipping them to the grocery store.
And well, that's what us consumers are looking at from the outside saying, look, you guys, you got to start to mix and mingle here in your supply chains.
And in the short run, they're working on that. So there are certainly attempts to redirect things. But they're all the little things that are required. And simple things like the bananas sold to restaurants tend to be small and not in bunches. That's not the way we buy them in stores. Beer might come in kegs to a restaurant and in bottles or cans to a store. So the repackaging, you know, 50-pound bags of flour isn't something you're going to buy in the store. And it's often then comes down to a matter of that processing packaging capacity to get it into a form that can go into the store that is the bottleneck. And they're working on shifting some of that over and getting creative about that. But again, it takes some time to do that because it's designed for a particular type of product, particular types of quantities.
Pete, what are your observations and what's happening in the food supply chain?
I think the points that Greg made about packaging misallocations are good ones. So my son is in a K-12 school district, and some of the school districts are still providing lunches for the students. So every day I see this white school van going through the neighborhoods and doing drop-offs at the homes. And they always tend to bring at least one or two milk cartons, you know, the 8 ounce half pint cartons. And with all of these kids not in school right now, and so much of a milk supply, they're still trying to find a good use for that. Some days we even get a pound of delicious Wisconsin cheese curds delivered. So, again, you know, what Greg was bringing up is, you know, there's misallocations of these different sizes. You know, there's a lot of milk and cartons that needs to be used up. And the fillers of these, it takes time to change their processes and their planning to allocate correctly.
Well, Greg, you know, shouldn't the industry and the manufacturers go through some type of stress test like the banks do? I mean, to test the wherewithal of these supply chains.
You know, that's a great analogy. I think that, well, first of all, supply chains are very decentralized things. There are a bunch of companies making decisions in coordination with each other, but also independently in their own self-interest. And the challenge is, and I'll go back to the example of the earthquake and tsunami in 2011, if you design, Pete mentioned this a little bit earlier, there are efficient supply chains. If you look at the other end of the spectrum, there'd be very responsive and adaptable and flexible supply chains. The problem is those flexible supply chains tend to be more expensive. And if you set up your supply chain to be very flexible, and then you try to run it for 10, 20, 30 years, whatever amount of time might elapse before there's something big like this that happens again, it's very cost ineffective, and you would probably be at a severe competitive disadvantage if you as a company did that and other companies didn't. There's always this pressure to try to be efficient, and that, in fact, might be the right way to go about it. What I would be in favor of is if somehow the industry, perhaps in collaboration with government entities, is to kind of draw a roadmap, kind of a railroad switch, that if we are doing things in a very efficient way, that might be the right way to do it for a decade or two. But we know that something like this could easily come again. And we need to have a roadmap that already has sort of drawn the paths that we then switch over. You know, this distributor is now going to start working with these entities to move things into a different supply chain if one gets shut down. Because we know what's going to happen. If we have another pandemic in 20 years, we are going to shut down restaurants and grocery demand is going to expand. It's a relatively predictable pattern. So my hope is that supply chains can write a playbook that they can implement when the next thing happens.
We're talking with two experts from the UW Granger Center for Supply Chain Management, Greg DeCroix, their academic director, and Professor Pete Luxis with us, senior lecturer, and you with your questions about the goods and items that you can't find, you can find, and what is happening behind the scenes as they get to market. We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So let's take a look at what the heck is going on with face masks. Pete, back in March, there was this shortage of surgical masks, other protective equipment, PPE, now that we all know that acronym. How did you see face masks transition from something that was relatively cheap and available to something that had a vast shortage?
Well, there certainly still is a shortage of a lot of face masks. If we think of the N95s at hospitals, the hospital surveys are still showing about one quarter of hospitals in Wisconsin have a 7-day supply or less. So there is a shortage. I think it's helpful to understand kind of how we got here. It happened so quickly. So back in back in December, January, when the pandemic hit China, hit the Far East, really those countries, those governments bought up a lot of the supply of the N95. So, you know, in the U.S., we have 3M, we have Kimberly-Clark, Honeywell, DuPont. There's maybe a half dozen large N95 mask manufacturers and some others. And there really is a shortage because the demand is something like 300 million a month. And those U.S. manufacturers can only make about 50 million. So the demand is just exceeding what the production capacity is and having to catch up to meet this anticipated demand.
So vastly outstripping demand. And so then what happens? Where are we at today?
Right. So there's a lot of creative efforts going on. If we look outside of the N95 masks to more of the cloth masks that many of us are wearing, as well as procedure and surgical masks, there's a lot of makers efforts happening. So there's one at UW-Madison right now. There's a team that I'm involved with, individuals from School of Human Ecology, as well as the College of Engineering. And we designed a UW face mask, prototyped it, select the materials, because a lot of the materials are in short supply as well. And we're having a contract manufacturer in Wisconsin, Lackey and Joyce. They've been around since 1844. They just produced the first pallet. And it'll have a little Bucky tag on it, and we'll probably be seeing some around campus here.
So where is your market? Where would people buy them or get them? What do you anticipate as that end stop there with the consumer?
Right. So a lot of these makers' efforts, some of them are being commercialized, and you know there's IP, intellectual property around it. For this particular one, we're not selling it. It's just more for the UW community. We would have to ramp up production more, and it was never our intent to sell these. There's other makers' efforts going on, like with face shields. The UW Makerspace, in collaboration with a number of local businesses, has open sourced a face shield design, and now there's dozens, if not hundreds, of companies making these face shields around the world.
Okay, so sharing the pattern, that way other companies can pivot, adapt, and ramp up production.
Exactly, and have production happening where the need is, which makes sense logistically.
We have two experts from the UW School of Business talking supply chain with us, Pete Luxis, Greg DeCroix. We're spending the hour on how U.S. supply chains are holding up, falling down sometimes during this pandemic. Do you think critical supply chain should undergo some sort of reorganization, maybe a stress test in the future? Are you a manufacturer? What industry are you in? And what do you see about your supply chain amid the pandemic? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about supply chains all hour. The Asian Development Bank is trying to make some order in the chaos. Last week, it released a study that maps supply chains for critical products during the pandemic. Mapping these supply chains means that banks and investors and governments can use the data to quickly relieve bottlenecks and ramp up supplies. So where do you see needed efficiencies or transparency in getting goods to market? What aspects of business do you work in, and how have you seen your supply chain broken or adapting? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. We have Pete Luxis and Greg DeCroix there with the UW School of Business Granger Center for Supply Chain Management helping us out. So, Greg, I want to look at price gouging here for a moment. You know, in some states, there are really strict laws around price gouging. Certainly during a hurricane like in Louisiana, your hotels, they cannot charge more than, quote unquote, air quotes here, normal. Gas stations can't gouge. But how difficult is it to enforce gouging? And what do you see there?
That's a good question. I'm not a legal expert, but I think that it is fairly difficult to enforce it because prices fluctuate naturally in regular times and even more so when things are a little bit more disrupted. And it's appropriate to some extent for prices to fluctuate when conditions change. And it really boils down to supply and demand. And one of the things, we see huge price increases in the world of N95 masks, but maybe I'll talk for just a moment about the food supply chain. And what might be surprising to some is the fact that farmers and growers and ranchers are seeing prices drop for many things that they're trying to sell, but grocery store prices in some cases are increasing substantially. And that would seem to be like a case of gouging. But it really comes down to something, the processing, particularly, let's say, meat processing plants that are in the middle. As many of those, as you mentioned earlier, have been hit by illness among some of their workers, they've had to cut back on they either shut down or they scale back in order to try to preserve some distancing. Well, that processing plant serves as the demand source if you're a grower or a farmer, and it serves as the supply source if you're a consumer or a grocery store. And so if the capacity there goes down, what's happening? Upstream for the farmers and ranchers, their demand has dropped, and therefore the price is going to drop. And for the grocery store distribution channel, the supply has dropped, and therefore prices are going to go up. So it's kind of a natural byproduct of supply and demand. Where it crosses the line into something that could be called price gouging as opposed to just prices fluctuating with supply and demand,
That's very fuzzy.
On that, just because, I don't have the legal expertise to know exactly where that line is drawn.
Well, Pete, I know I had to put in a new air conditioning compressor last weekend, and the air conditioner person said, "Yeah, steel's costing more, so this is going to be hundreds of dollars more for that compressor." You know, based on when you priced it out 5-6 months ago. I can see it there as your, raw materials, they fluctuate, go up and down. But do you, can we see any type of situations such as in the area of N95 masks where there might be issues of being taken advantage of?
Certainly. N95s typically, may cost a buck or two, and now, prices have gone up $6, $7, $8. A lot of companies and organizations like hospitals or even state governments are turning to international buys. So instead of going through their normal medical supply distributors, they're getting more creative and they're saying, we can't get from the manufacturer, we can't get from the distributor. Let's see if we can find these somewhere else in the world. And, when large organizations are trying to buy hundreds of thousands of N95s, going through like a trading company or something, which is a middleman in between a manufacturer and the customer, that's where some of these gray markets begin to happen. And there could be 3X, 4X, 5X types of markups in negotiating these deals, as well as other risks.
Well, let's take another call. Don is in Mequon. Hi, Don.
Hi there.
Hi, go ahead. What's your question?
No question. I just was listening to your show, and I found it fascinating because we have also seen a real change in our we manufacture an ice vest that goes under foundry workers and people who wear Tyvek suits and work in high heat work environments. And we have watched a real surge in our product. We've had to kind of retool a little bit. We make FlexiFreeze, which is just pure water that you freeze. And ordinarily we ship it overseas where it's made into our ice vests and then ship it back. But what we've ended up doing is having to cut it here, and we've had to regroup our whole supply chain so that we can meet the demand, because healthcare workers underneath those Tyvek suits are...
they need to be cooled off.
They need to be cooled. It can some high heat work environment, people that are working in heat, like it can raise up to 120, 130 degrees. And I don't know how you like your steak, but that's medium rare. You have to draw the heat off of the body core somehow. And ICEF does that, but you know, we've had testing facilities call us. Healthcare workers under the PPE. It's been a little bit crazy.
Wow, Don, thank you for bringing your story. Greg, you know, an ice vest manufacturer changing production there and bringing it back here and not doing it overseas.
Yeah, that's a perfect example of the kinds of things we see all over the place. And I honestly wasn't really even aware of that product. And I love it when I learn about something like that. But it's both the supply and the demand. I mean, demand in terms of the intensity that we're asking of our medical practitioners, the demand is going up for these things. But she mentioned overseas. I don't know where, but it sounds like, you know, it's quite possible it's somewhere in an Asian country that might have been shut down or partially shut down due to the outbreak. So both the supply and the demand are affected in opposite directions, which makes it particularly hard. And finding a workaround, in this case, a workaround that's domestic and avoids the need to try to work with a market that's being severely affected is the right way to go.
Let's bring in Bennett now in Madison. Hi, Bennett.
Hi, how are you?
All right.
I just have a question. We have a small deli and grocery store in Madison, Wisconsin, and we didn't see a whole lot of supply shortages as far as the imported products we get, like from Italy and other parts of Europe, until about, I don't know, maybe 2 months into the pandemic. And I'm just trying to, you know, figure out how long that would last or why there's like that delay in, you know, us being able to get our products or get our hands on products like flour and tomato products and things like that, especially from Italy right now.
All right. Greg, in the food area, do you want to go first?
Sure. I'm going to take a little bit of a guess. As Pete said earlier, each product is a little bit different. But to some extent, you know, there usually is some amount of product in the supply chain. If it's an efficient supply chain that's running very lean, there might not be a lot. But particularly you mentioned tomatoes, and I'm going to guess maybe canned tomato products, flour, pasta, things like that would be non-perishables. And so there would quite possibly be a certain amount of that in the supply chain. So even once things start to really shut down, that may get flushed out of the supply chain and that supply may continue to come. And it's only once whatever the bottleneck is sort of shuts off the flow and that then works its way through the supply chain, that's the point in time when one would actually stop getting the product.
Well, Pete, we only have a few seconds left, but anything else that you could add there for Bennett?
I would just add to, you know, thank you to all the retailers and grocery stores and food service workers out there. For Bennett, I would just add too that I think having retail operations that have at least been up somewhat, let's say with curbside pickup or at least doing carryout, that's kept these supply chains flowing. So it's been at least a little easier for these restaurants and retailers to start up again.
Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, Kate.
And that was UW School of Business Granger Center for Supply Chain Management, Greg DeCroix, Academic Director, Pete Luxis, Senior Lecturer. Just ahead, it is On Point. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.